Trial Lawyers College versus Jerry Spence's Trial Lawyers, 28028. We'll hear from appellant's counsel, please.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court, I intend to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal. There's four reasons for why this court should reverse the district court's entry of a preliminary injunction against Jerry Spence and the other appellants. First, the district court should have abstained from ruling on the preliminary injunction motion under the Colorado River and related doctrines due to the earlier filed Wyoming state court actions. Second,
well, counsel, aren't these cases so very different in parties, in claims, in relief sought?
The parties are substantially similar. The difference between the parties themselves is only one party, which is the legal entity that the appellee added to this federal case. So, but for that one legal entity, the parties are identical. And as courts have noted, identicality between the parties is not the test. It's substantial similarity, especially when a difference in one party is due to the second filed suit adding a party.
What about the claims? The claims are different, aren't they?
The claims are different. The Wyoming state court case concerned a dissolution and derivative action filed by these same parties against TLC and the other board members. But the underlying issue that both courts would need to decide is the same. And that was the basis for our motion for stay. The underlying issue is, who is the rightful, lawful board of TLC? Is it the one faction, the Sloan Group, that purports to be acting on behalf of TLC today as the appellee? Or is it my clients, Jerry Spence and the other appellants who were board members and, as pursued in the Wyoming state court case, continue to believe that they are the rightful board members of TLC? If that issue is decided in favor of my clients, that obviates this entire lawsuit. So on that ground, because then my clients would be the appellees, they would be the individuals who would have the lawful right to control the appellee here, and this case would be instantly moot.
But the district court focused on the difference in the parties. Now, which party is in front of the state court, not in front of the state court, but is in front of the district court in this case? Is that Mr. Spence?
Correct, Your Honor. The same.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. Isn't that very important from a Lanham Act standpoint? Is it that Mr. Spence be bound by any adverse judgment under the Lanham Act?
It would be important, yes, Your Honor, but if Mr. Spence is TLC, if Mr. Spence and the other individual appellants who are my clients, if they are TLC, if the Wyoming state court ultimately rules they are TLC, then they are authorized to use these trademarks. There could be no trademark infringement because the individuals being accused of trademark infringement would be in control of the appellee itself. The second reason why we believe that the lower court's preliminary injunction order should be reversed is the appellee's failure to prove irreparable harm. The lower court's reliance on the purported evidence of irreparable harm was both legally incorrect and factually unsupported. Third reason for why we urge this court to reverse the entry of the preliminary injunction, at least with respect to appellant Rex Paris, is that the only evidence against Mr. Paris was improperly admitted after the hearing, after the close of evidence, and he was given no opportunity to rebut or respond to that evidence.
Well, on that last point, weren't you given the opportunity to respond and rebut?
We were not, Your Honor.
The court said, you know, if you want to submit the entire video or audio or whatever you had there that portrayed Mr. Paris, you could, and you didn't, right?
The transcript of that audio already was in the record, so that wasn't the issue. Merely providing the remainder of the transcript when the entirety was already in the record would not have cured the prejudice to Mr. Paris. The issue was he had no opportunity to address or respond to what he had said in the earlier transcript. The district court made a supposition saying what the district court thought we would argue if given that chance, and then ruled against us based on the court's incorrect.
Did you seek that opportunity at any time?
We did, Your Honor. We filed an objection to the submission, the untimely submission of that, and requested that the court either strike it or give us an opportunity to respond.
But isn't that it? Go ahead. No, I'm sorry. No, you.
Did you then say to the court what you wanted to provide? Or just did you say we want to respond, Your Honor, and the court said respond and you didn't respond? Is
that— No, Your Honor. We objected. We filed an objection, which is in the record as being improper, and requested the ability to respond. And the court came out with its preliminary injunction order a few days later. And in that order, he addressed our objection in the manner I just described.
And then nothing happened after that, as far as you offering or seeking to offer evidence in rebuttal.
Correct. The preliminary injunction order was entered at that time.
Isn't that issue fairly limited? And that is, it affects only Mr. Paris, not the other defendants in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor. And right, frankly,
so as to the other defendants, it's irrelevant.
Correct.
All right. And also, even as to Mr. Paris, don't you have to show some prejudice?
Well, the prejudice is that he was bound by a preliminary injunction order that he would not have been bound by at the conclusion of the hearing.
But we need to know how he explains the statements that he made. Don't we, in order for we to determine whether or not any response would be relevant?
Well, there's a procedural flaw, which is the focus of our argument. The fact that we were never allowed the opportunity to respond. Substantively, as we explained in our brief, if you look at the transcript, it's apparent that Mr. Paris wasn't even listening to the question that preceded his comments. One of the other speakers says, "I don't think Mr. Paris has even heard you." So when Mr. Paris responded, he wasn't responding to, and if given the opportunity, he would have explained this, the prior question, he was speaking generally about the status and direction of TLC.
Did you tell us that in your briefs?
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. It was in our opening and in our reply.
Specifically, what you just said, that your explanation to your answer on why it is prejudicial is it was misleading because Mr. Paris was not listening to the question. That's in your opening brief. Remember it, but
I would need to find it, Your Honor. I don't have a citation, but I believe it's.
Yeah, I just don't remember that. Okay,
I tell you, I don't either. That's why I asked.
Okay, and frankly, me arguing what he would have said, the attorney saying he would have said this when he wasn't given the opportunity to say that, and then have the court evaluate that testimony. That is the issue.
Well, we all know that you can make a proffer, don't we? I mean, you could say, Your Honor, if given the opportunity to call Mr. Paris to the stand, he would say 1, 2, and 3. And that's totally contradicted from this audio that you now have.
We were not afforded the opportunity to make that proffer before the district court. The last reason for why we asked this court to reverse the preliminary injunction is the breadth of the injunction. We contend it was an abuse of discretion because the lower court imposed a mandatory injunction in two respects. One is it effectively constituted a gag order on the appellants, preventing them from expressing the positions that they were pursuing in the Wyoming state court case. The second part of the mandatory injunction piece is the ordering of the removal of two sculptures that had been installed at the Thunderhead Ranch, which went beyond the claimed irreparable harm that was before the court. Now, jumping into the irreparable harm issue, the court cited two bases for claimed irreparable harm in this case. One, loss of monetary damages, and two, actual confusion. Monetary damages is easy to dispense with. Monetary damages, by definition, is not irreparable harm, and it was legal error for the court to cite monetary damage as an example of irreparable harm. As to actual confusion, the record shows that there was no actual confusion. In fact, the appellee in their response brief didn't even try to defend the court's conclusion on that, effectively conceding that.
I thought there was a lot of evidence about confusion. I thought that there was evidence that everyone was asking questions. Who's in charge? What's going on down there? Who's on the board? Or, you know, what's happening?
That's exactly right, Judge Briscoe. That's
confusion, right?
That's exactly the type of questions that were happening. And two points about that. One, inquiries, and the law is clear on this, mere inquiries, customers asking questions, that's not actual confusion. In fact, raising the question shows that the people asking the question recognize there's an issue. Actual confusion is someone actually being confused, a misdirected phone call, misdirected sale, a misdirected donation. There was zero evidence of that. That was the first point. Second point is, given what had happened in this case, all of the drama between this very public, acrimonious split between the Sloan Group and the Spence Group, and the Spence Group, Jerry Spence, the foundation, evicting TLC from the Thunderhead Ranch, and then filing the Wyoming State Court dissolution action, and then the Sloan Group retaliating by trying to vote the Spence Group off of the board, and then a few weeks later filing this action. All of those activities unquestionably and unsurprisingly created lots of questions by the alumni in the manner that Judge Briscoe, you just articulated. One, that's not actual confusion, that's questions, that's inquiry. And two, those don't have to do with the allegations of trademark infringement in this case. Those were related to what was going on with this very public acrimonious.
Don't we have evidence as well of a drop in donation by persons who had previously donated?
We have evidence from the treasurer who said there was a 10% drop in donations.
Wouldn't that go to show confusion? That is, we don't know who's in charge anymore. I'm not going to write a check until I get this clear.
Well, again, Judge Briscoe, that's not confusion. Somebody very prudently saying, I'm not going to write a check until the dust settles and the Wyoming State Court decides who's in charge. That's not trademark confusion based on trademark infringement. That's people making an informed, prudent economic decision. I'm not going to give my money till I know who my money is going to. That's actually recognizing the very issue. That's almost the opposite of confusion. The other point, though, Your Honor, is if there was a loss, an actual drop in donation, and I should point out there was no evidence tying this drop in donation to any specific conduct by the appellants, but let's assume that there was. That's a monetary loss. Monetary loss is redressable by monetary damages. That's not irreparable by definition. I see my time is almost up. I'd like to reserve the rest of it unless the courts have any more questions.
I do have a question.
Yeah, Paul, go ahead and stop the clock,
though. What sculptures are we talking about that are part of this injunction?
There are two of them. They were in the form of the trademark registrations that were filed by TLC. So it looks like a cloud with sort of three peaks and then a thunderbolt coming out of the cloud. That depiction was and had been the registered cattle brand for that ranch. That registered cattle brand was registered back in the 1960s by Jerry Spence. And that was the brand for that ranch.
I understand that. What are the sculptures you're talking about?
Oh, well, one's a large metal sculpture that's on top of the arch, a large wooden arch. It's maybe 20 feet off the ground as you go into the ranch. And the second one was a wooden with painted version of that that was affixed to the side of the barn on the property.
Now I know from experience that many ranchers put their brand on the top of the arch as you enter their property. Is that what that particular sculpture is? Is it the depiction of the brand?
Correct. That was the registered cattle brand, which that's what it was before TLC, the appellee, adopted it as a trademark. It was originally a cattle brand.
All right. And it's not.
But it is a trademark.
It's also, yes, it was subsequently adopted by the appellee as a trademark.
And both of these sculptures are still where they originally were, one above the arch and one on the barn?
Not now. They're both removed. The court enjoined, part of the mandatory injunction was you need to go out and either cover up or take these sculptures down.
Thank you.
And the ranch is used for things other than just the convening of this trial lawyers college, right?
Yes. I mean, it's a ranch. And so individuals affiliated with the Jerry Spence Foundation or Jerry Spence could go to that ranch with permission, but it's primary during the time before the split, before last year, its primary role had been as the home of the appellee. The 3-week college was held.
All right. And in that regard, does the record indicate whether or not the ranch is now a working ranch?
The record does not indicate that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you. The court recognizes the appellee.
May it please the good morning. May it please the court. Chris Ralston on behalf of the Appellee Trial Lawyers College. We ask this court to dismiss the appeal of the denial of the motion to stay because we believe the court lacks jurisdiction over that. If the court does believe that it has jurisdiction, we ask that this court affirm the district court's denial of the motion to stay or to abstain from deciding this matter. We also ask this court to affirm the grant in part of preliminary injunction that the district court issued after its evidentiary hearing. As the court knows, the Trial Lawyers College has since the 1990s been training and teaching litigators how to hone their jury trial presentation skills and techniques. Since 1994, the Trial Lawyers College has rented or leased space on the Thunderhead Ranch for the purpose of holding educational programs. Throughout that time, the Trial Lawyers College has protected its intellectual property. It's maintained, it's protected, it's policed it. And in 2011, the Trial Lawyers College registered with the United States Patent and Trademark Office after the unanimous vote of the board, the Trial Lawyers College mark, referred to as the 908 mark in our brief. It also trademarked the logo of the college, which is the stylized design depicted in our brief, known as the 054 mark, which consists of a cloud with a bolt of lightning through it. In late 2019.
Is the order of Judge Carson to remove the 054 mark from the side of the barn, do you agree with your adversary that that is a mandatory injunction. It is actually ordering them to do something affirmative.
I disagree with counsel, and that was something that we discussed at the hearing, Your Honor. The order was to cease infringing or using our marks, our federally registered marks, in various places. In response to the court's question, I'll mention one of our concerns, and we discussed this with the court, was that where people were out, the public were out at the ranch, a non-working ranch, that would continue to cause dilution of our mark, damage the distinctness of our mark, because we'd, of course, been evicted by that point.
Maybe I'm just not understanding the answer. Does the order, in your interpretation, require the appellants to remove the 054 mark from the ranch, including the period of its current inactivity, based on our last information, because of the pandemic? Do they have to do that under Judge Carson's order?
They have to cease displaying that under Judge Carson's order.
Even if they're not operating the college?
Well, that was something that the court asked counsel. Remember, they told the appellants told the court that they weren't going to have any activity out there. And sure enough, last month, they held a 3-week educational program on the ranch. The appellants did. So that's exactly the type of concern that we represented to the court, which was that by leaving our logos and our marks up on the doorway and up on the barn and up on the wall, that people would understandably be confused that that was the entity that had been there for some 25 years before, prior to its eviction by the appellees. And so I hope I've answered the court's question on that.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Ralston, in response to your first response to Judge Bachrach, you said this is a non-working ranch. Opposing counsel says the record doesn't indicate one way or the other. Are you saying the record establishes this is a non-working ranch?
I believe that the court's question, Judge, and I'll ask see if my colleague can find a citation for that, but I don't think that was really in dispute before, because there has been no...
Well, I don't care whether it's in dispute or not. It does the record indicate whether this is a working ranch or a non-working ranch?
I fear that it doesn't use those words, but I don't think that there was any question that the only thing that's been going on at the ranch...
Where in the record would we go to determine that this is not a dispute, that the Spence Group would agree with you that it's non-working ranch? Where do I go on the record to find that?
Your Honor, I will. My colleague is looking for that as we speak, because to be honest, I can't.
All right. Well, when he gives you the citation, give it to us.
Thank you, Judge. Yes, sir. In following up on my previous argument, the point that we made in our brief was that Gulfstream Aerospace, as followed by this court, holds that when you have a collateral order on a motion to stay, that's not on its own appealable as an interlocutory order. I will mention that we did file a Rule 28 letter. We also believe that motion is now moot, because although it wasn't revealed by counsel, the state court judge has now affirmatively found that the appellees are the governing board of the Trial Lawyers College, and has also found that the appellants, the individual appellants, are no longer board members. In fact, I didn't want to burden the court with another rule.
Do we have a supplementation to our record of all this new information?
The Rule 28 letter we did file with the court last spring when the state court issued it, Your Honor.
Okay. And so we have documentation of that in our record and when the court issued its order.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Your Honor. That's correct.
Mr. Ralston, your position, it's moot. It's moot in a non-jurisdictional sense, correct?
We believe that now that the court, we believe it's moot in an Article 3 context, which is that the argument the counsel made.
If that's the case, I mean, they have a general claim for dissolution in state court.
Yes.
If you're dissolved for whatever reason, then there's no more trademark claim. So why doesn't that mean that one affects the other and overlaps?
Your Honor, I don't believe that, and this is again discussed at the district court level, that there's any argument that even if the matter were dissolved, that the defendants could then, at least while we were still a go existing entity, use our mark for competing enterprise in a deliberately confusing and misleading.
Well, if the entity is dissolved, TLC is dissolved, I think that kind of dissolves your litigation in this court. Isn't that correct?
If it were dissolved, that would affect the litigation. But
well, and that's part of the relief they were asking for. So in a general sense, you can't say that the mootness issue is jurisdictional. It just relates to one of the issues, and that is the correspondence of the, which group is in charge. It does not resolve the dissolution claim.
That's true, Your Honor. And what I was trying to say was it resolves primarily what their argument to the district court was, which is you shouldn't decide this trademark issue right now because of all the things that are going on in state court. And all I was saying was most of that has now been resolved contrary to the appellant's argument, which is that the court found they didn't have standing to file a derivative action. They aren't board members. They are no longer part of the board of the Trial Lawyers College. And so most of those arguments that justified their argument for a stay or for abstention are no longer in existence, Your Honor.
That's, yeah. So I just want to make sure that I'm not thoroughly confused. So I understand your argument to be because there's an adjudication in state court that to the extent that Mr. Getzoff is challenging the denial of the motion for a stay, that part is moot. But your position is that the appeal over the denial of a preliminary injunction is unaffected by the state court ruling.
Correct, Judge. It only relates to the appeal of the order denying the motion to stay.
All right. Thanks.
I'm sorry if I confused that. That's not what I was just addressing the denial of motion to stay and their argument, their notice of appeal on that issue. Okay. I will cite Judge Murphy in response to your question. Record site 0297, and I'm just reading from the court's ruling at the top of the page. It's that although the court acknowledges that the proposition of branding livestock is similar to the principles underlying the trademark law, the use of the cattle brand at issue is not an issue in this case. If the Spence Institute runs cattle on the land, something it has not contended, the court would not prohibit it from branding cattle. And the court goes on to discuss what the site is being used as a site for continuing legal education. And so I don't think it says.
But that does not resolve the question of whether or not it's an opening, an operating ranch. It's just they didn't make any claim.
Yes, Your Honor. They did not make any claim that it was an operating ranch.
All right. Are you going to address irreparable injury soon?
Yes, Judge. I'll go to that now for the court's question. I think that the argument that the appellants made that the court didn't address irreparable injury is just belied by the record. At appellants' appendices 303 through 305, the court specifically addressed the irreparable injury issue. We know that in instances from this circuit, citations from this circuit, that when an entity has to spend time dispelling confusion from its customers or potential consumers, that can support a finding that irreparable.
How do we now the confusion evidence is not clearly from consumers. It's kind of from patrons, isn't that?
It's probably worse. That's right. It's from both. It's from both our own alumni who would normally be giving their annual pledges. And there was testimony that had diminished while people did exactly what Judge Briscoe said, I'm going to wait to find out who the real trial lawyers call. Right,
but they're not customers.
Well, they are alumni, is I believe what the evidence in the record, although we now have continuing issue of potential future registrants that are to this day calling us, asking us how to get to the program that's the Spence Foundation.
Well, okay, let's move on with those folks. As I understand, you had a virtual meeting with them and you dispelled all confusion. Isn't that what the evidence indicates?
No, Your Honor. But we did. The testimony was that there was continuing calls to the ranch, emails to various board members about who is the right entity, who is really the Trial Lawyers College, and that's specifically because the evidence that Judge Carson cited to, which was a YouTube video posted for the world to see, where Jerry Spence used both of our marks in the video, and says the trial lawyers will continue at the Thunderhead Ranch. Of course, your average consumer or a lawyer that would know that for 25 years that the Trial Lawyers College had been at Thunderhead Ranch would be confused into thinking that it's continuing. and but not being told that it's now continuing by Jerry Spence Trial Lawyers College at Thunderhead Ranch, deliberately meant to confuse. This is an egregious case, Your Honor. Judge Murphy, I know you penned the decisions in the Heartland SPCA case, as well as the Badass Coffee. This is even more egregious than that, because they deliberately sent out an email to all of our alumni, those who continue to give annual pledges, and said, there's been some technical difficulty. Please switch to this listserv. That was deliberately meant to mislead those people.
Yeah, let me stop you, because I think what Judge Murphy's asking you is not whether or not it was really, really bad. He's asking you about irreparable injury. And I just want to make sure that we're clear about that. One of the arguments that Mr. Getzoff makes is that to the extent there was a 10% drop in donations or any other economic damages from people not continuing to patronize or to contribute to the college, that is a classic species of legal damages that you can recover. And by definition, that is not irreparable. I never saw your response in your brief to that point. So could you address it now? Why is an economic drop or a loss in economic goodwill that is reparable, how can that possibly be irreparable injury for a preliminary injunction?
Thank you, Judge Bacharach. And I understand the rule that monetary damages almost avoid irreparable injury. I understand that point. But I think Judge Parson used that only to show that people were responding and have responded to this change in circumstances. And so
doesn't the fact that they're not responding and that it is compensable and that you can sue and get damages at the conclusion, doesn't that by definition show that the injury is reparable?
If it were limited to a 10% drop, perhaps, Your Honor, but obviously what we're concerned about is people that, as even last month, were calling us confused about the program. And once they go to college, once they go to this school, they're not going to go to another one. And so he specifically cited it would be understandable for people to think that when they're registering for Jerry Spence's Trial Lawyers College at Thunderhead Ranch, what they're really registering for was what's been there for 25 years.
No. And did you have actual complaints from people who wanted to sign up?
We did, and Mr. Clary testified about that in the lengthy evidentiary hearing that the court held. I mean, it wasn't just one isolated instance. This was repeated because of, you know, and my opponent makes it sound like everyone cleared it up. The whole world knew about this. This was up in Wyoming. This is something that was a very surprising change that after 25 years, the Spence Foundation would evict the Trial Lawyers College and immediately set up a competing name using our mark, and then trying to mislead the world by sending out YouTube posts saying the college is going to continue right here at Thunderhead Ranch. No different than if I were the owner of a Burger King and I evicted them and then put Chris Ralston's Burger King the next day where it had always been or for 25 years, people would think that they were still ordering from the same location, from the same purveyor. And that, Your Honor, has in the Tenth Circuit repeatedly been said, when you're damaging someone's reputation or the goodwill that they've established or diminishing the distinctiveness of their mark, again, by trying to meld them into one, that does support irreparable injury and that criteria. I recognize that I'm running out of time. I'm happy to answer any questions, but I think that when you look at the—
You're out of time.
We would just ask the court affirm Judge Carson's ruling.
I have a question, Mr. Ralston. As I understand it, what the court said, at least in part, was that people are starting to ask all sorts of questions about it. There's confusion, including the members of the Sloan Group. That's to the extent that the court may have relied on that evidence to find irreparable injury. That's contrary to our precedent in Jordache versus Hogwild, is it not? Which, as I read it, specifically forecloses a conclusion of irreparable injury predicated on questions.
I know I've read Jordache Enterprises. I'm familiar with that. I understand your point, Judge. I think, however, though, that it's more consistent with recent precedent, which says that when you've got this much similarity between the two, that you're going to confuse people. And I think when the court made factual findings of actual confusion and misleading and concerns about changing in behavior, that that certainly was supported by the record. And I think under an abuse of discretion standard, which we have here, I think that's not even a close call. Well, I just thought that one citation he made for that, I understand your point.
But if we conclude, if we may or may not conclude this, that Judge Carson relied at least in part on questions being raised by consumers, do you agree or do you disagree with the proposition that that reliance would have been tainted, that reliance on that would have been misguided, even if there had been other evidence that the court could have relied on to define irreparable injury?
I respectfully suggest, Your Honor, that even if the court wrongfully relied on one of the numerous pieces of evidence that he found, that that would overturn the other at, on a preliminary injunction with lower evidentiary standards pursuant to this court's entitlement with a limited amount of discovery and evidence. And he's trying to make the best call he can. He had a lengthy hearing, heard a lot of testimony. And so I don't think that if this panel finds that that was erroneous, that that would overturn all the other things that he painstakingly tried to set out and limit and be careful to qualify in his ruling there.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for indulging the panel. Judge Briscoe, do you have any questions?
No, I don't. Thank you.
Judge Murphy, do you?
Yeah, on this matter about Mr. Paris, this interview took place before the hearing, correct?
The interview took place before the hearing, yes, sir.
All right, so you had access to that.
We did not get access to that until after the hearing came out and certain people listened to the testimony. That was forwarded to us by someone who had listened to that interview.
All right, so as I understand it, the record doesn't show when you received it. There's nothing in the record one way or the other as to when you received it.
That's correct, Judge.
All right. But we do know that the interview or whatever it was, the statement was made before the hearing.
It was made before the hearing.
Wasn't it made within the earshot of people who were sympathetic to the Sloan Group?
To be honest, Your Honor, I don't recall at this point who forwarded it to us. I believe it was forwarded to someone who then forwarded it to our one.
I can't ask that. That's not in the record. But we do have the statement, and it's in the record. And as I understand it, that it was made in the context that there were persons sympathetic to the Sloan Group who would have been in the audience to hear that.
Your Honor, I just don't know the answer to that because I wasn't there. One of the things that we were surprised about, and obviously Judge Carson asked some questions to Mr. Paris. There was other evidence already in the record cited in the court's ruling about Mr. Paris postings on the listserv. So he was already implicated. I think that caused him to question Mr. Paris's assertion that he really had nothing to do with this entity. Frankly, to be honest, none of us anticipated he would testify to that because that was not disputed. So when that testimony went out, as I recall, in response to your question, Judge Murphy, the people were so surprised that he would testify to something like that, that they forwarded it on a transcript or some tape recording of the interview. And then Judge Carson gave him an opportunity to put the whole to explain it or explain it in context or put whatever he wanted to into the record, and he chose not to. Just in response to your question earlier, for the sake of the record, Mr. Paris never...
I understand your answer. I understand your answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Okay. The court recognizes the appellant. You have 27 seconds, Mr. Getzoff, and you're on mute.
Thank you, Your Honor. In terms of the timing, the CLE where the Rex Paris statements, that was over a month before the preliminary injunction hearing. The transcript of that was submitted to the court about a week after the actual preliminary injunction hearing itself, where Mr. Paris was given no opportunity, nor was he confronted with that testimony. The dissolution action is still ongoing. That issue is not moot. And as Judge Murphy noted, there depending on what happens, this case very well may be dissolved. My time is up. Thank you, Your Honors, for your time. We respectfully request that the court reverse the entry of the preliminary injunction order.
Okay, thank you. Judge Murphy, do you have any questions?
I do. What is the status of the record as to confusion? Let me call it alleged confusion coming from people who would use the services, who would attend the seminars, versus those who donated money. What is the status of that evidence?
At the time of the preliminary injunction order or today?
At the time of the preliminary injunction order.
Well, there's no evidence. Nobody was putting on trial training services at that time because of COVID. So there was no evidence of any customer or donor or potential customer or potential donor because there simply were no services being offered at that time.
Okay.
The evidence was of alumni. So these are prior customers. These are people who have gone through the course. They stay in touch with TLC. Those are the people that voiced their questions to the effect, what is going on, who's in charge, et cetera.
And that is the pool of people, I take it, from that would contain donors.
That is correct.
Does it contain, is it part of that pool, people who would go back for an advanced course?
Potentially, yes. The college did offer advanced courses. There's no evidence of anyone prospective in that bucket. I think the donor category is really what we're talking about.
All right. So, and so if I review the record, you're telling me with confidence, I'm not going to see anything about consumer confusion. I'm going to see questions from donors and potential donors.
Correct. Yes, with confidence.
Right. Am I going to see anything more than questions?
No. And importantly, the questions, those questions would have arisen without any of the allegations in this case. I mean, there was nothing in the record tying the questions to the allegations of trademark infringement. If you think about it, when TLC purports to kick out its founder and leader, Jerry Spence, that they only lost 10% of donations, or that they had the questions that they have, that's surprising it was that small. Who would give money to an organization that just kicked out its founder and leader for the last 20 years? So the lack of evidence tying any of this alleged loss or harm or confusion to the allegations in this case, that's where they failed to prove irreparable harm.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel. This matter will be submitted.